The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Matt Wells. Party conference season is over. The result, a new leader of the Labour Party, Tories buffeted by middle-class rage, and the Lib Dems apparently quite happy with their new role in government. That's not the end of it. Later today, 19 lucky Labour MPs are elected to the Shadow Cabinet, and on Monday, Parliament is back in full swing. To spread a veneer of sense over it all, we have in the pod Guardian columnist Anne Perkins. You're just back from the Tories, Anne.
Just back, yep. Yeah.
And Nick Cohen, Observer columnist. You've been to Tories and Labour.
Yeah, just back from the Tories as well.
Jolly good. On the line, our very own Michael White. You've been podcasting daily. You've been to them all, Michael. You've got the hat trick.
I believe so, but it's so many weeks ago now that we went to Liverpool for the Lib Dems. My time of life, I've forgotten.
Well, we'll come back to all that later. We've heard from all the party leaders the first time each has had the opportunity to take stock and spell out the direction of travel to their own parties since the election.
Your country needs you, and it takes two. It takes two to build that strong economy. We'll balance the budget, we'll boost enterprise, but you start those businesses that will take us to growth.
Our council leaders know the poorest are the ones that suffer when the finances get out of control and money has to be spent on debts.
And when you reduce your economic policy simply to deficit reduction alone, you leave Britain without a plan for growth.
It takes two to build that big society. We'll reform those public services, we'll devolve that power, but you step forward and seize that opportunity.
They know there is nothing fair about denying you have a problem and simply leaving it for the next generation to clear it up.
No plan for growth means no credible plan for deficit reduction.
Don't let the cynics say this is some unachievable, impossible dream that won't work in the selfish 21st century. Tell them people are hungry for it. I know the British people. They are not passengers, they're drivers.
Would you ask your children to pay your credit card bill?
We must protect those on middle and low incomes. They did nothing to cause the crisis, but are suffering the consequences. I say, the people who caused the crisis and can afford to do more should do more.
So how did they fare? We took some advice from a speech-writing expert, Simon Lancaster. Here's what he said.
Comparing the three party leaders' speeches, this was not a golden year. No truly great speeches. But if the measure of success is approval from the audience in the room, then Ed was the winner. He had a strong theme, renewal, strong lines, Red Ed, come off it, and really strong positioning, slaying all three of the big new Labour dragons one by one. Blair on Iraq, Brown for claiming to have abolished boom and bust, and Mandelson for his reliance on focus groups. In contrast, Cameron and Clegg both seemed at odds with their audience, missing the register. Lines that were designed to prompt applause stiffed, whilst the audience clapped at unexpected points. This was particularly the case with Cameron. There were breathless periods in his speech when he was begging for applause, trying to prompt sustained applause he could surf like Brown did last year. But it never came. Clegg and his audience just seemed tetchy. It was painful to watch. It was like he couldn't believe how ungrateful they'd been, and they couldn't believe how he'd sold them down the river. It reminds us that the fault lines in this coalition lie not between Cameron and Clegg, but between Cameron, Clegg and their parties. The most important element in a good party conference speech is having a single line of argument with clear goodies and baddies. Cameron achieved that this year with his "We're all in this together." And Ed Miliband pulled it off as well with his "all things old are bad and all things new are good." Although, of course, the only flaw in his argument was that it sounded exactly like Blair's Forces of Conservatism speech, which is now 11 years old. The thing that really doesn't work well in party conference speech is clichés. Clichéd themes like visions and values, changes and choice. Clichéd constructions like "I met someone in my constituency" and "to those that say." And clichéd words like responsibility, fairness and freedom. But that's the trouble with politicians. They'll speak in clichés till the cows come home.
Simon Lancaster there. Mike White, you were at all of them, as I said. How would you assess each speech against the others?
Well, I'm halfway with Simon Lancaster there, except I'd take issue on one important point. God, we all hate clichés, don't we? But they're old familiar friends too, is that you know, Ed Miliband succeeds with his audience, but of course that's a critique of the Miliband speech, that it was too comfy with the audience and perhaps not comfy enough in challenging the audience or in talking to the people at home. And when you make a speech at a party conference, you've got two audiences, a sort of bifurcation. You've got to keep the audience in front of you from booing you, which was, as Simon Lancaster said, a bit touch and go with Clegg. I thought it was funny to say that they weren't grateful enough that he's Deputy Prime Minister. Lucky old him. They didn't quite see it that way. But equally, you've got to, you know, you've got to have people busy with their lives, watching on TV at home, saying, "Well, hey, that bloke sounds all right, better than I thought. We'll give him a bit more attention." So always attention in what a party leader says. I thought they were all perfectly competent speeches. I liked very specifically Miliband towards the end of his speech, as I recall, talked about, you know, being an optimist. I'm an optimist. And Cameron saying much the same thing in a different way. And all the evidence is that in politics, optimism pays. People like to be told the tough stuff, but also to say, we've got a vision for the future. We're going there. We'll get through it.
Well, Ed Miliband said he was an optimist, and David Cameron said he was a radical. David Cameron had to kind of pull it back, didn't he, from a slightly difficult beginning to his conference. Did he manage it?
Well, he did by completely ignoring the crisis that his Chancellor had provoked by not necessarily wrong but ill-thought-through cuts on child benefit. I thought it was really interesting listening to that compilation, actually, because in whatever Simon's professional assessment of them, Cameron is a superbly good deliverer of a speech. And I thought, just listening to that little bit, you know, you can hear, you know, he's just, you know, he uses his voice beautifully. And it's true that little passages that were supposed to get people clapping didn't work. But, you know, compared with the really flat delivery of Ed Miliband. And the truth is that Cameron does have that kind of, you know, kind of polished, sunny appearance, which Ed Miliband does not at the moment. Ed Miliband looks a lot less like an optimist than Cameron does.
Steve Bell's panda.
What do you think, Nick? I mean, your view is that he, you know, despite these bits that we talked about of the speech that didn't quite work, that he does manage to tickle the right parts of his audience, so to speak.
Well, I had an experience of chairing a fringe meeting packed with Conservative activists. And there was Min Campbell from very sceptical Liberal Democrats about the coalition, and Nick Bowles, an absolute enthusiast Conservative. And I virtually had to stop the meeting and try and find one Conservative activist who would criticise the coalition. So, I mean, I think he's got his party members on side, as you would expect when, you know, he's the first Conservative Prime Minister for 13 years. I sort of agree with Mike in a way. In that if you listen to Cameron's speech as a whole, there were false steps, and it wasn't a coherent speech. But later that night, watching the news, he comes across, as Anne says, very polished, a political pro. And Ed Miliband is still a work in progress, I think.
What about, Anne, this idea that we touched on a few minutes ago about the whole child benefit cut? It seemed as if it came out of the blue. It felt like, looking at it from outside, a real misstep to announce this at the start of the conference.
Yes, it did. And I mean, Mike, I suspect, will know more about the background to it than I do, but I mean, they obviously wanted to be able to talk about fairness and to say it wasn't just, they weren't just going to get at benefit claimants. And they wanted to have something to say about that. I fear, rather like Sam Cam's extremely expensive frock that she was wearing yesterday.
£730 from Paul Smith.
At least what it indicates is that so many of them earn so much more than the 40% floor at which tax change will kick in, that they simply didn't realise that there are a lot of people at that margin, although they are relatively a very small number taxpayers, who were really going to feel it.
Is that right, Mike?
Well, it's interesting territory that. I was buttonholed on the last morning of the Tory conference by a member of the cabinet who said, you know, the British media really have Fleet Street's finest disgrace themselves this week, going completely ape about the 15% of people who are going to be families who are going to be affected by this cut. You know, it just tells you that Fleet Street is out of touch what real people earn. Most people don't pay higher rate tax, and higher rate taxpayers, quite a lot of them, quite well to do. And, you know, Fleet Street doesn't get it because it doesn't really understand the realities of most people's lives. They're all quite comfortable. And it just being vested interest. They won't make half as much of fuss when the other cuts come on later because they affect people not like themselves. I thought that was a bit cynical and a bit, as Anne said, a bit out of touch. But nonetheless, there's a point there. We can defend universalism, but we've seen a maneuver by George Osborne, which, A, as Anne said again, protects the coalition from saying we're just dumping on the poor. We can now say we've hit our own supporters, exactly the sort of thing Tony Blair would have tried to do, and also saying we're sharing the blame, we're sharing the pain.
Anne, this is right?
Yeah, it is. I think the real colossal stupidity, which really makes me wonder what they were thinking about, is the absurd inequity that, you know, if you're a single income family on 44,000, you catch it. And two on 40,000 don't. And I can't quite think why that one wasn't realised. And I think this is a pattern.
Well, they
sort of
did realise it, didn't they? But they just ignored it.
It's unavoidable. Yeah, anomalies are always unavoidable.
Unified credit, that'll go.
Unavoidable.
That will go. But I think that they've got form on this. All through the election, policies came unstitched because you felt that they'd not really thought through in the way that, you know, in the heyday of New Labour, nothing went out that hadn't been tested to destruction.
That's flattering.
Nick, this is because that although the leadership of the Tory party like to portray themselves as being one of the middle classes, they're actually not, are they? And there isn't anyone in that bracket who are in the same boat as the people that they're trying to appeal to.
The Conservatives and indeed Liberal Democrats or anything are, you know, Liberal Democrat cabinet ministers can often be richer than Tory cabinet ministers. They are very vulnerable to the charge that they are the wealthy. They have a noblesse oblige sense of duty towards the poor, but the people in the middle are somehow left out of their story. And Mike says it was unavoidable, not means testing child benefit cuts, not saying, for instance, any household earning more than 50,000.
Yeah, George Osborne said it would mean a complicated change
that Gordon Brown means tested it. He did it for virtuous reasons so that the people in most need would get it. Concentrate the money you've got on those who really need it.
The trouble is
that it draws more and more people into means testing,
which is why we have universal benefits. But Mike, the serious point I want to make here is this. I mean, we're just going to have to get used to this because we're about to have a comprehensive spending review. And how many of those cuts, there's a kind of manic atmosphere in Whitehall at the moment. Oh, isn't this marvellous? We're going to be able to do it. Everyone's egging each other on. I bet you when you start examining cuts in detail, you'll find, like as with the child benefits, you'll find inequities. You'll say, well, why have they done it this way? Why not that way?
Yep.
They are rushing into things.
Yep.
And talking about a 25% cut in departmental budgets, as this is going to be easy to obtain, there's going to be a huge mess, I think.
They're already saying it may take... The FT this morning has a story saying, well, we'll delay it a bit. Well, that's no surprise.
This is, I've got the FT story here, which the Treasury, by the way, has been rubbishing this morning. But it's very interesting. It looks to me very, very well sourced, Anne, doesn't it? This suggestion that the Treasury are going to delay the savings and cuts.
And I think, I mean, with delay in the sense of kind of spread them slightly more evenly. And I think they're making the right noises that you can't cut safely and quickly.
They're reprofiling them, is the word.
Reprofiling. I like that. I'm going to remember that one. Reuse it in conversations with my bank manager.
but I mean, it sounds, Mike, as if they're a bit tetchy on all of this, and they're starting to wobble. Do you get that sense?
Well, they're new to government. As with Tony Blair, the parallels are so interesting. Blair hadn't run anything. Somebody said, the trouble is you, Prime Minister, the only thing you've ever run is the country. And they always think things are easier than they are. None of them have experience, apart from Ken Clark, of government. And you come in full of good intentions, noble virtues. Gosh, how wholesome and innocent David Cameron sounded much of the day yesterday when making that speech. And then they find it's difficult. And just as they say, welfare reform, gosh, we've got all these brilliant ideas, getting people back to work. You say, come on, guys, you don't think that Labour government and the civil servant haven't been trying to cure the housing benefit problem, which incidentally Margaret Thatcher created for 13 years. They haven't been sitting on their bottoms. It's harder than you think, and they're just beginning to learn that.
Don't you think that too, Mike, that they're kind of informed by Blair's first term in office, where, you know, they felt he didn't go at it hard enough. And Blair himself would say he didn't really kind of know quite what to do when he started. And so they want to kind of, that's why this kind of sort of absolute plethora of initiatives, like the NHS reforms, for example, are just, you know, they're just kind of...
Could I say that's a bit of a myth about Blair? Because Blair in his first term had devolved power to Scotland, a gigantic constitutional change. People would have thought with great,
yes,
all kinds of different, it worked well.
Yeah, no, you're quite
human
right.
Human rights, yeah. Northern Ireland peace process.
Yes.
And that myth is fueling the mania in Whitehall.
Yeah.
We've got to do this now.
Yeah.
We've got to do it all at once. You know, bull in the China shop.
No,
the
attitudes. You're right, Nick, but you're also wrong, because the things you rattled off were inheritances either from John Major, Northern Ireland peace process. Major deserves a lot of credit for that, but also from John Smith, that devolution, John Fiske's famous phrase, settled will of the Scottish people, blah, human rights. Blair was FOI, freedom of information. Blair, well, in his memoirs, he
rather regrets it, doesn't
it? Yeah, but he was stuck with doing it, just as he was stuck with Frank Dobson as health secretary. That's the card he was dealt. Public service reform was the thing he regretted not doing sooner, because it was much tougher than he thought.
No, all I'm saying was, it was the first Labour Parliament, and the first Labour administration was quite busy.
And the myth
that it wasn't, that everyone just sat around saying, we've won an election, is fueling the mania in Whitehall.
Let's get back from the past right up to the present. I want to, before we just move on to some more general terms, I want to have a quick go around on the big society pitch, which Cameron tried to make again this week in his speech. And he's refined the pitch, hasn't he? So it became this Churchillian Kitchener style thing, what you can do for your country. But I'm still not convinced that it's clear enough to hit home.
No, it's clearer, but I think, as Johnny Friedland observed, you know, I don't think Cameron's own party completely understands what he means, and one kind of feels that Cameron doesn't necessarily quite understand what he means. I think it's also a significant point that, you know, people are feeling a little bit too vulnerable at the moment to be, you know, thinking about joining an army of volunteers. Although, I mean, you know, at the same time, I think, you know, that, in a way, you know, aspiration becomes holding on to your job, and values simultaneously do rise up the agenda.
Mike, do you think it'll work eventually? Because he's not letting it go, is he?
No, he's not. I understand what he means, and I'll tell you why I understand, because I've been to the little Berkshire village of Peasmore, where he grew up. It's just north of Newbury, on the north side of the M4. And Cameron has spent his entire life in a triangle between London, Peasmore, and, let's say, Oxford, or his constituency just west of Oxford at Witney. And it's a wonderful part of the country in many ways. Witney's a cracking little town, and Peasmore's a nice village where people like his family live behind high hedges. His mother's a magistrate there. His brother's name is on the board as faded, weather-beaten, unpainted board as chairman of the parish council. He's a QC in London, mind you. And that is a world of volunteerism and good works and helping out and all the things which is conveyed by Cameron's big society whenever he talks about it. Eton also fits within the triangle. And, of course, Oxford University. It's perfectly wholesome, but I don't think it's a viable model for much of the country. And I say that with regret, would that it was, but it isn't.
All right. Listen, one thing that the Conservatives have tried to do this week is stake out their territory in what is universally referred to these days as the centre ground. But what is this fabled land that holds the key to electoral success? Ed Miliband attempted to locate it in his speech, invoking the squeezed middle, and the coalition never tires of mentioning those hard-working families. But Nick, as you alluded to in your column this week, the borders of the centre ground are constantly shifting, aren't they?
Yes, I wasn't trying to say, when you mentioned Ed Miliband locating it, there's a leader of the opposition can redefine where the centre of British policy is. It's hard enough for a Prime Minister with a big majority to do. It's just that, well, if you go back a few years, there were speeches from Gordon Brown and David Cameron and George Osborne on the centre ground, which was essentially accepting Labour's spending, which is now being massively hacked back, light-touch regulations of banks. They were all accepting that the politics and the economics grew out of what was the longest boom in the history of capitalism from 1991 through to 2008, will be settled. Now, all those assumptions have been thrown out. I did notice, and I think a point of attack for Labour, that however interesting Cameron's speech was, and it wasn't a terrible speech, and as I think it was Anne or Michael said, you know, he's an optimistic, he's a pleasant character, you think he's a serious politician. At no point does he mention that the reason why we're nearly £1 trillion in debt is not really that Gordon Brown spent too much on hospitals and education and diversity outreach coordinators and all the rest of it. It is the British banking system collapse in a global financial meltdown. And for it ought to be an advantage for the centre-left, because the resentments among the public about this are so large and justifiable, to keep pounding on about this and to notice that when the Prime Minister doesn't mention the banking crisis, it's a rather ominous sign that perhaps he has no intention of reforming the banking system during his tenure.
And do you think is the centre ground, they all talk about it, is it the place to aim for, isn't it? It's where elections are kind of won and lost, and voters locate themselves.
It's a kind of curious place for a radical to find themselves, I would have thought. But I mean, Cameron's way of describing it is kind of catchy and quite persuasive. You know, you win a elections on there, the opposition, the government's centre ground, and then you move the centre ground to where you want it to be. And that's plainly what he's trying to do. And there was an interesting observation in Ben Brogan's column this morning saying that Cameron is becoming reconciled to the idea of only being a one-term prime minister. And he thinks it's worth doing if he can, in effect, complete the undoing of the post-war settlement, which is what he's engaged on.
Yeah, which is different from what we hear that George Osborne wants, was he's determined to win the next election solely as the party of government.
It's quite smart politics to suggest that what you're doing is so important you'll stake everything on it then.
All right. The business of politics continues. Mike White, the Tories and their media allies haven't tired yet of the red-ed label for the Labour leader. Will that influence his decision, do you think, when he comes to allocating posts in his shadow cabinet probably tomorrow?
I think with red-ed, it's a bit like Bambi. Do you remember Blair was meant to be Bambi? You try things out. Bambi to Stalin in 1 week, I think Blair said on one occasion. The public knows what resonates. Gordon Brown could never shake off his image as a dour puritanical Scotsman with a penchant for being over complex. It's up to Miliband to persuade people that he is who he really is. That may not be satisfactory, of course. I think he has a rather puritanical streak in him somewhere, and I don't think voters go for Puritans by and large. They go for optimists, as we said a moment ago. Shadow cabinet portfolio, it's a mug's game. I haven't a clue who's going to get what. I don't know who's going to win, although somebody took me aside on the station platform in Birmingham yesterday and said, you know, it's all fixed, don't you? They all give their ballot papers to the chief whip or somebody like that, and they pick who they want. I don't believe it for a moment, but it did bring me up sharp. Let's see what the results are first.
Yes, it's probably it's very foolish, as Nick Robertson will probably now admit, to predict things that are just about to happen, so perhaps we shouldn't. But
it's always good advice not to do that.
Yeah, but Anne, if you talking broadly about who he picks in the shadow cabinet, it will kind of define. He has to deal with the cards that are dealt with him, of course, with this bizarre way that the Labour Party does business in opposition. All eyes are on the shadow chancellor position, but it's not just that, is it?
Not just that, but he does. I think he's obviously got. He's got one message which I bet he's really keen to promote in his choice of jobs for people, and that is his commitment to gender equality. He's already kind of, you know, was eager to accept the idea there should be at least six women in his shadow cabinet, and indeed there are already two automatically because Harriet Harman and Rosie Winston, the chief whip, are in there.
By virtue of being deputy leader in chief.
Yes, quite so. There is talk that Yvette Cooper may well come top. And if she did, could you not make her
At least her husband wouldn't be able to complain.
No, that's true.
You don't know their marriage.
Well, listen, no. Let's leave all that aside. Now, listen, we've come to the end of party conference season. It's the end. We've seen all this new generation, Nick, as they've all sort of styled themselves.
I'm the old generation.
are you really? What do you make of it? What do you make of this? Is it really a new breed of politics, do you think, or politicians?
Well, they're all rather young, and I'm not sure that's such a good idea for the voters. I think the Conservatives and Liberals in particular lack, with the exception of Ken Clark and Eric Pickles, sort of old-style reassuring populists who in hard times can go out and put bang their the message drum, across. Yeah. You know, well, you know, you need that. You need people who can speak above the Paxmans and the Humphreys and just go and talk for the country. And I'm not sure this government has got too many of them. But I do think the interesting question that's just come out of this is what happens to the Labour Party. It's not so much what Ed Miliband does to his shadow cabinet, but do the shadow cabinet say this is a disastrous government following a disastrous economic policy, which what they seem to believe, we will unite around Miliband and try and pull the Liberals away, or will they just carry on with faction fighting to which they've had many years of practice.
All right, Nick, I think on that note, that's a very good note to end on. Nick Cohen, thank you very much. Thank you also to Anne Perkins and Mike White. That's it for Politics Weekly this week. We'll cover all the shadow cabinet fallout next week on the programme. Producer this week was Phil Maynard. I'm Matt Wells. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.